This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. On this episode, we talk about the ongoing struggle in the Ukraine. But first, here on Liberation Radio, we've been following the Syriza victory in Greece pretty closely. And recently, Syriza calls for the end to the austerity program and is calling also for reparations from Germany. To explain all this, we have on Radhika Miller, progressive activist and lawyer from Washington, D.C. Radhika, the new Syriza-led government is calling for an end to the austerity program that has inflicted so much pain on the Greek working classes. Help us understand the context for this demand, the origins of the austerity plan, which came about after the 2008 global capitalist meltdown, and how austerity works and its effect on the living conditions for Greek people.
Yeah, sure. So I think the first question is really what caused this? And for that, we kind of need to take a step back and see what the financial crisis was and, you know, what it was not. The financial crisis, you know, global financial crisis, really was a consequence not of the actions of Greece or the Greek worker, but really the consequence of a global crash, really, in the capitalist economic system. And that crash wasn't caused by workers anywhere in the world. It was caused by banks and, you know, primarily by the biggest banks on Wall Street. So, you know, through their thievery, through the mechanisms of the capitalist system, which is really the never-ending drive to maximize profit around the world, those banks actually had racked up liabilities greater than their assets. And that's what caused this global bankruptcy. You know, we in the United States know that there was a huge bailout here alone to save some of those banks. But that didn't save the world economic system, which really just suffered a complete breakdown. And, you know, tens of millions of jobs were lost here. But in Europe, and really the poorest countries of Europe, tens of millions more were lost in Greece and Italy and Spain. You know, people here say we suffered, you know, this recession. In Greece, they don't fail to call it what it was, which was just a major economic depression. It is the Greek depression for them. And, you know, as a result, with these, you know, their economy collapsing, these countries couldn't pay on their debt. So we're talking about Greece in particular here. They couldn't pay on their debt. The inability to pay these debts, you know, it is significant, I think, in the context of what we're talking about today, to know that the biggest of these debts were owed to foreign banks, basically mostly in Germany and France, the European Central Bank, the EU, which also significantly is really under the domination of Germany, which is the most powerful economy in Europe. These banks came together along with the European Central Bank, along with the, you know, the Eurozone countries, the EU, and the IMF, to craft a quote-unquote bailout for Greece. Essentially, in short, what we have with an austerity program, and particularly the one in Greece, is we're taking things from the working class. We're slashing the minimum wage, you know, we're privatizing our government, businesses, you know, all those things. We're putting limits on salaries, we're capping salaries so that we can give money to these banks. So you're taking from the working class, which again, didn't cause this crisis. You know, and I talked about the frame, which is that what we're seeing, you know, also in the mainstream media, we're seeing it, you know, the frame come from Germany itself, which is that, and the EU, which is that, you know, Greece was reckless. They couldn't take care of their own economy, like a very patronizing view of it. That this is what caused this big debt that Greece cannot repay. And so here we come. We have to save the Greek workers. But in order to do that, we have to, you know, make sure they're doing things right and make sure that they're implementing the right taxes and restructuring the way we want them to do. I mean, that's the frame that we're getting now.
Right. And you reference, I mean, you keep referencing Germany, and the new Greek government is demanding that Germany pay reparations to Greece for the damage done to Greece and the Greek economy by the Nazis during World War II. That's a pretty interesting political move. If Germany were to pay reparations, that would take care of nearly half of Greece's public debt. Of course, the German ruling class's initial response has been negative, to put it mildly. But tell us more about that demand, too, for reparations and what exactly the Nazis did to Greece and how the issue probably will play out.
Yeah, so, I mean, as you said, at the same time that, you know, Syriza is really calling for a renegotiation of the terms of these loans that were given out. And they're, you know, they're saying, you know, we want to pull back on austerity, give us a little more time to pay. It includes, you know, some portion of forgiveness. And the big thing, you know, that happened most recently, as you said, is that they're saying, you know, Syriza's saying, you know, Germany actually owes reparations to Greece for the occupation and the devastation caused during World War II. And as you mentioned, the amount that is being thrown around is actually half of what Syriza, you know, Syriza says, you know, about, I think, 150 billion euros is what would be owed. And so if Germany would forgive that, or actually pay that, that would actually cut the debt in half that Greece is responsible for, which you can understand would mitigate, so, you know, the burden on the workers, really. So they're not calling for complete, you know, forgiveness of debt. What they're saying is, you know, okay, well, if we owe this debt, let's go back to, you know, what happened in World War II and how we got here to begin with. You know, during World War II, and actually to take a step back to just talk about German debt from World War I and World War II, there were two things that helped lift Germany out of debt, World War I and post World War II. You know, first, the Marshall Plan, which was basically the reconstruction of Europe after World War II, didn't include any form of reparations from World War II and didn't even discuss the past debt that Germany never paid. And then there was a London Accord, which basically cut older debts, post World War I debts, and, you know, private debt as well owed to the U.S. government in half. So they cut Germany's debt by 50% and really boosted that economy. And, of course, you know, that was the imperialist plan to make sure that West Germany could join the imperialist countries, could have this thriving economy, and could succeed. And so, you know, what Greece is asking for is essentially, you know, a similar type deal, which is being completely refused. But Greece actually has more ground to stand on because Germany completely devastated Greece during the Nazi occupation in World War II. I mean, during the occupation, which lasted about 3 years, the Nazis stole, plundered, you know, requisitioned, quote unquote, material, goods, food, forced labor. On top of that, you know, Greece had to pay the cost of the occupiers being there. And the government also had to give a war loan to Germany, you know, to the tune of 476 million Reichsmark, which actually has never been repaid. So Germany has never paid anything for the Nazi occupation and devastation in Greece. But right now, the unemployment rate in Greece is more than a quarter of the working population. 26% is unemployed. And then when you look at youth unemployment, it's more than 50%. But, you know, Germany is staunchly refusing and, you know, in doing so, leading the countries of the EU and, you know, the central bank to even consider any sort of forgiveness. And what Greece is asking for is not even forgiveness, right? It's what's owed to them.
It's going to be interesting to see how it plays all out. We have like another minute or two here, and I wanted to ask you one or two more questions. You know, the political nature of Syriza and its political orientation, I think, is still kind of up in the air. People are still trying to figure out, you know, where exactly they are. But like all political phenomena, there's many contradictions. Can you talk about some of the challenges and opportunities with Syriza?
Yeah, sure. I mean, just really quickly, I know Syriza has been discussed on the program before. You know, it's a mix of things. The government is a liberal populist government. There's a far left wing to it. The significant thing that's here right now is that, you know, because they were elected and elected by a lot, 36% of the vote, you know, that indicates a shift to the left in the Greek electorate and an opportunity for leftists to push, you know, the working class struggle even further. But it's significant that, you know, the KKE, the Communist Party of Greece, won't work with Syriza because there's a real opportunity to do that for leftists to really join together and, again, push things forward. But there's also a real danger in not doing that because significantly also, you know, the fascist party, the Golden Dawn, increased its base support in the electorate. And, you know, we've seen this before. We saw it. I keep going back to Germany with the Nazis in Germany. That when the struggle intensifies and there's extreme hardship, the right wing can take advantage of this. And so if we don't have leftists joining together, even in this moderate call for a renegotiation of terms for the debt, and then, you know, through that, whether it succeeds or fails, showing that in order to really succeed, we need a complete repudiation of the system, you know, if we don't have that and it fails, then and the leftists didn't join in a united front to do something about it, you have a real advantage for fascists to take control. Mm. It's what happened with the severe economic hardship in Germany in the 1930s. It's not an accident. And so we need to take this opportunity, join together, push forward globally as well as locally to show really what true success looks like and use this. People are shifting to the left and the working class is struggling, and we should use that opportunity to push everything forward.
You're tuned in to Liberation Radio, and you can check us out on our website, liberationradio.org, on Facebook at facebook.com/liberationradioshow, and on Twitter at the handle Liberation Radio. For the past few weeks, the struggle in the Ukraine has escalated. We got a chance to speak to Brian Becker, National Coordinator of the ANSA Coalition, to talk about the developing situation. This interview was recorded prior to attending a ceasefire that was called this week, and we'll be continuing to cover this story as it develops. So, Brian, we've seen the fighting in the Ukraine go to different levels throughout the past year. Why has the fighting intensified in eastern Ukraine in the recent period?
Since January, since the early part of January, the Ukrainian government, which is a pro-American government, a government that owes its existence to the U.S.-sponsored coup d'etat that ousted the old democratically elected government last February, that government has initiated a military offensive against the what are called the separatist elements or the pro-Russian elements in eastern Ukraine and southern Ukraine. It was an effort by the Ukrainian government to sort of renege on or undo the Minsk agreement that took place last September that led to a temporary truce, or at least a diminution of military conflict between the central government in Kiev and the rebels in eastern and southern Ukraine. I believe what the United States was doing, and when I say the United States, I say so consciously, because there's no possible way that the government in Ukraine, the new government, the Poroshenko government, which came to office after the February coup last year, could take any sort of large-scale military initiative in eastern and southern Ukraine, one that would bring the country and perhaps the entire region to the brink of war. They could not have done that without the green light from the United States and the Pentagon. And so I think what we saw happening was that the separatist or pro-Russian or anti-fascist rebels, however one might characterize them in eastern and southern Ukraine, in Donetsk and Luhansk and other areas who have been oppositional to the fascist or pro-fascist or fascist-led government that came into power after February 2014, they had consolidated their authority as a regional autonomous or semi-autonomous zone, one that would still remain part of Ukraine within the national entity of Ukraine, but one that would have a great deal of independence or autonomy, and one that would be essentially friendly to the existing Russian Federation and its government. The attempt by the Ukrainian government in January to oust the rebels from their positions of authority that had been sort of ratified by the Minsk Agreement was, I think, an effort by the United States and Ukraine and the other NATO powers to test the resolve of Russia, because Russia has had severe economic sanctions imposed on it. The 50% drop in petroleum prices, and Russia, of course, is the largest producer of oil in the world. All of that has taken a big toll on the Russian economy in the last 6 or 8 months. And I think the United States wanted to test Russia, whether or not Russia or the, because Russia supports the rebel forces in eastern and southern Ukraine, whether they would withdraw and hold back support while the Ukrainian government took this military offensive, in the hope that the Russian government would start to find a way to ease economic sanctions, again, at a time of great economic difficulty because of the falling gas prices.
Right. And
but I think that...
Oh, go ahead. No, I was going to say, what do you, speaking of Russia, tying it in, what do you think the significance of the French president and the German prime minister meeting with Ukrainian leadership and Vladimir Putin of Russia? What's the significance of that?
Well, François Hollande, the president of France, and Angela Merkel, the prime minister of Germany, traveled first to meet with Poroshenko, the central government in Ukraine, and to Vladimir Putin the next day in an attempt to find a way to have a ceasefire in eastern and southern Ukraine. Again, I would say they came as a consequence of the fact that the separatist rebels, I think with the help of Russia, although Russia denies it, have been able to push back and essentially defeat, inflict serious heavy-duty casualties and military setbacks on the Ukrainian government's offensive that began in January. And as a consequence of this, they are now sort of attempting to have a peace plan. And they want to do it because while the United States is content to impose sanctions on Russia and to use the Ukraine as a device to ratchet up hostility against Russia, the European countries that have a large amount of trade with Russia are the ones who are suffering the economic consequences. And the European Union, including France, are on the verge of recession. Germany's a little bit better off, but still suffering because it's part of the EU. And so as the U.S. carries out this point of confrontation with the Russian government, using Ukraine as the sort of the axis for that, Europe, even the European capitalists, are feeling the brunt of that. And so I think Hollande and Merkel were trying to see if they could find a way to end this or have a ceasefire in eastern and southern Ukraine, go back to the Minsk agreement in September, which would allow the rebel forces to exercise a great degree of autonomy. But, you know, even if Russia agrees, and I think Russia would be very willing to agree, the bottom line is that the power behind the Western countries, the real power, is U.S. imperialism, which is not allowing the European countries, even the most powerful ones like Germany and France, to exercise an actual independence. And so they can't get the United States to sign off on the cessation of hostilities, at least not so far. So we see a high-stakes game being played out. The United States keeps escalating the tension, struggling to defeat the separatist or anti-fascist opposition in eastern and southern Ukraine, pushing Russia to the edge, working with Poroshenko, who says the top priority of his government is to incorporate the Ukraine, Europe's second-largest military, into NATO, into the NATO military alliance on Russia's borders, something that could not help but be perceived in Russia as a direct threat to Russia's national interests. So the United States keeps escalating, pushing the envelope, and of course Russia is feels threatened. The European countries are feeling the consequences of economic sanctions, and the people in eastern Ukraine are suffering. Thousands have been killed. I mean, it's not a big story in the U.S. media, but thousands of people are dead, killed by their own government. Can you imagine if Syria, I mean, if a central government drops bombs on its own people, the U.S. government, the U.S. media would be saying, they're killing their own people. Well, that's what's happening in Ukraine. The central government is killing its own people, and 500,000 to 1 million Ukrainians have been made into refugees. They're not fleeing to the West, they're fleeing to Russia because they feel a safe haven there. But we see the U.S., through its aggressive policy, extremely aggressive policy, not just the Republicans, but the Obama administration and John Kerry and the State Department, having essentially adopted the neoconservative agenda of complete military world domination, have now created a crisis that did not exist a year and a half ago, but one that now threatens not only regional peace, but possibly a global military conflict.
Well, you know, speaking about the U.S. government's role in all this, you know, the relations of U.S. government and the principal NATO powers, they keep saying that there's a lot of unity. Is there truly unity, or is there more divisions that are being spoken about? And also, too, can you also bring in there, you know, there's been the new progressive party that won the elections in Greece, Syriza. What kind of part are they playing in the whole NATO dynamics?
Well, in terms of the U.S.-NATO alliance, or the U.S. alliance with Germany and France, let's remember that since World War II, since 1945, the principal cornerstone of U.S. military and foreign policy has been to take all of the other major capitalist powers, countries that fought against each other in World War I and World War II, and unify them under the hegemony of the United States. In other words, after World War II, instead of repeating the post-World War I era where the defeated parties were victimized, like what happened to Germany in the Versailles Treaty, the United States resuscitated the German economy and the German elite, the ruling class, and the bourgeoisie. They did the same with Japan. They gave them market share in the world market. They turned them into junior partners of the United States in the so-called Cold War, which was a global united front of imperialism and capitalist countries against socialism and communism, and where those powers were relegated to junior partner status. Now, since the end of the Cold War, the United States wants to maintain the same sort of hegemonic relationship. But Europe, historically and naturally, would start to gravitate in the direction, really, of Russia, which is a major European economic and military and political power. The United States doesn't want that to happen. And so the United States, partly for its own sort of greedy imperialist objectives, but partly in order to maintain the post-World War II alliance, has continued a policy of almost sustained hostility and tension against any Russian government that seeks to be independent, nationalist, assertive about its own rights. Again, because Germany and France could easily start to align themselves with Russia. Mm. And that would be the end of the post-World War II world order. Ukraine has created, again, because it was a U.S. coup d'etat, a U.S.-sponsored coup d'etat, even though the EU countries, Germany and France, also supported the Maidan protests. They also supported putting pressure on the Yanukovych government. They were not supportive of the fascist-led coup d'etat on February 21st that overturned the entire diplomatic order that had been established. And the U.S. hailed that as a great new day in Ukraine, the fact that these, you know, 5 of the 11 new ministers in the Ukrainian government were actually Nazis or neo-Nazis. That was still heralded by the United States as a great new day for Ukrainian freedom. That wasn't the case in Europe, where the European governments were worried that this whole sequence of events had gotten out of hand, that the United States was unilaterally pushing the envelope, creating a confrontation with Russia, that would then Russia allow Crimea to affix itself again to Russia through a referendum. They realized that Europe, which had been victimized, or, you know, sort of the battlefield for two major world wars, one that took the lives of 25 million, the second that took the lives of 60 million, that Europe too could again be plunged in what seems to be the unthinkable madness of a global conflict. And so you see that Europe is starting to manifest differences. Mildly manifest them at first, but I think this will grow and grow against the U.S. plans that threaten them, especially with another world war. In the case of Greece and the Syriza government, and Greece, of course, is a member country of NATO, Syriza said Ukraine should not be brought in to NATO, that that would be a violation of the agreements that the United States and Western powers signed with Russia after the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, so that the United States and NATO would not take every ex-Russian ally, former socialist government ally, either part of the Soviet system or allied countries in Eastern and Central Europe, and then absorb them into what amounts to an American military and economic sphere of influence. Syriza says the Greek new Greek government is not for that. That sets a stage for a new contradiction within NATO, and I think we can see also that Greece is trying to buck the tide, trying to say to the German bankers and the French bankers, we don't want the Greek working class and the Greek people and the Greek economy to have austerity shoved down our throat. We don't want to be living in dire poverty just so that we can pay the biggest banks in Northern Europe a debt that the problem for which is not ours. It's the creation, actually, of the global capitalist economic crisis of 2007. So it's possible that we could see a new alignment, that not only where Europe, not only France and Germany start to exercise some degree of independence from the United States, even though it's hard for them to do so, but the poorer countries in Southern Europe, in this case led by the new social democratic progressive government in Greece, could start to also realign if the pressure is so great, or if there's no relief brought to bear for them on the austerity, they could start to align too towards Russia. So the entire existing world order faced with these new contradictions could be challenged. And I would say, when we finally look at it at the end of the day, U.S. imperialism in its sort of unbridled aggression in Ukraine on Russia's border, Russia's most important historic ally, the U.S. government holds the responsibility for upsetting the world order that it itself has benefited so much from. It's the dialectical part of current modern imperialist politics.
You have been listening to Liberation Radio, a weekly program from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can find us online at liberationradio.org to listen to past shows and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Some of what you heard during this program are Creative Commons licensed compositions. Our theme music and some music segments were performed by Six Fingers and used with permission of the artists. Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation to help build the struggle for socialism in the United States. The PSL is a party of activists and organizers. We are in the streets at the demonstrations and picket lines, opposing cutbacks and attacks on workers, standing up to police brutality, fighting for immigrant rights, and struggling against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all forms of bigotry. We stand in solidarity with oppressed peoples around the world resisting imperialism. We believe the crimes of capitalism call for a new kind of society, and we are committed to fighting for it. To find a PSL branch near you, see our upcoming events and learn more about how you can get involved. PSLweb.org. Again, that's PSLweb.org. Also, the PSL's Liberation newspaper online at liberationnews.org, where you can read our news articles and analysis or purchase a subscription to the print edition. Thank you for listening.